Now, tonight we have with us another member of the faculty, Andrew Gardner. Andrew earned his BA in philosophy at Georgetown and his MA and PhD both at the University of Arizona. He teaches courses in the Department of Comparative Sociology and focuses his studies around the Gulf states of the Arabian Peninsula, where he has substantial field work experience in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Qatar. I asked for lessons. Qatar. It's one of about four ways to pronounce it. The reason I had to do that, and I thought I could get away with this because I just leave it out, but then I've read the next line in my notes here, and it said between 8 and 10, 2008-2010, he taught in the Department of Social Sciences at Qatar University. His most recent book, City of Strangers, Gulf Migration in the Indian Community in Bahrain, explores the experience of Bahrain's largest community of foreign residents and their governance by the Bahraini state. The book and Professor Gardner's work was recently featured in a New York Times piece back in February. He'll talk with us for a few minutes, make some remarks, and then engage us in conversation. Please join me in welcoming Professor of Anthropology, Andrew Gardner.
Hi, it's nice to see you all. I was telling somebody earlier that I've been doing this for a long time, and I still get butterflies. I don't know why. Anyway, I'm a cultural anthropologist, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Puget Sound, and the title of my presentation is In the Shadows of Skyscrapers, Labor Migration in Contemporary Arabia. And what I thought I would do is just kind of talk about a sequence of the three research projects that I've worked on, including my first research project in the region, the dissertation research, which has now been published late last year as the book, and then some of the new research that I started when I took a leave of absence from the University of Puget Sound and went back over to the region for 2 years with my family. And I'm going to proceed pretty quickly since we don't have a lot of time. I have a feeling that the questions you have for me will probably be more interesting than the kind of questions I was thinking of in my mind. So we'll kind of speed through this and then you can ask me whatever you want, okay? And I wanted to start with this picture. I guess it's kind of hard to see, but this was the view from my cot in the deserts of Saudi during my first trip there. And I love this picture because it was like a lunar landscape, like no place I had ever seen before. And the story behind this is great. In 1999, I was a graduate student in anthropology at Arizona. I had been trying to propose some research in French West Africa, and I think I was too early or something, but I just kept hitting up against a wall. So I started taking some Arabic courses. And one day, one of my advisors pulled me into his office and said, Andrew, I want you to go to Saudi in 2 months. I got this project, and I'm busy, so I need you to take care of this for me. You know, one of those kind of dream conversations as a graduate student where you're just waiting for these opportunities to happen. So of course I said, yes, I'll do it, whatever. And so he and I got on an airplane, we flew to Saudi, and he had this project set up that would carry us out into the empty deserts to find Bedouin nomads and interview them, okay? There were the two of us, and then there were five research assistants, Saudi guys from the government agency that sponsored us. And we took off in these land cruisers, and we were on pavement for about 1,000 kilometers, and then we left the pavement, right? And one of the things that I realized right away was that this would be akin to, like, going on a 2-month backpacking trip with five guys who had never left New York City, right? Because it was one disaster after another, including, since I'm on this sort of the view from the cot, every night they would insist on having this lantern in the middle of our circle of cots, right? And the desert looks empty, but it's not empty, right? And as soon as the sun would set and you'd set this light up, every bug for about a mile around would start its like slow trek to the light, right? And eventually they would begin to arrive in great waves. And I'm not talking small, harmless bugs, but I'm talking like giant black scorpions, extraordinarily fast spiders, ants, strange beetle creatures. And so these five guys would run around the camp with shovels trying to kill the bugs. As I was trying to say, let's just turn out the light. You know? But anyway, I should get on with the actual research. So the reason that we were asked by the Saudi government to come and do this had to do with the Kuwaiti oil field fires. So when Saddam Hussein's forces retreated from Kuwait, they lit those oil derricks on fire, and that created this cataclysmic environmental event. It's hard, I think, for you maybe to see, but there's this plume of smoke that begins here in Kuwait, and it stretches down here. This is Saudi, past Bahrain, past Qatar, and down into the Emirates, right? And this thing blew all over the place. It was we could sense it as far away as Japan and our weather stations in Hawaii. And the Saudi government wanted to know what was the long-term impact of this significant event on the deserts that these Bedouin nomads depend upon. Okay, and we were the people who were going to answer that question. And the interesting thing is all of the people that we talked to remember this event. It went on for weeks, and they would tell us about their animals getting sick and all the problems they had had since then, and how their white clothes would become black by the end of the day. And the problems with the animals were obvious. There were carcasses all over the desert. And so we did interviews for 2 months, and I'll show you some pictures just sort of from the desert. This is sort of our operation, our two cars, and then we found some guy out in the desert, and we're asking him for directions, actually, because we were terribly lost, and we're like, where can we find some more people to interview? And that was the kind of thing we would spend half the day looking for a tent. And then when we found a tent, it was great. You kind of go up and you circle in your cars, and almost all the time they wave you in. The women go to sort of one side of the tent that's partitioned, and then all the male members of the family host you, and that is where we'd have our interviews and our conversations about the history of this family, where they moved to, how many animals they have, how they make their decisions, what kind of problems they'd observe. We cast our net very, very broadly in these interviews. Here's some of the sheep and the water troughs that most of these families have to keep these sheep alive. Over the past 30 or 40 years, they've shifted from primarily camel to primarily sheep, right? And here's one of the interviews with one of the oldest guys that we talked to. Now, there's a million little details that we could talk about in terms of how I went about analyzing this. But to make a long story short, when I got home, at first I thought, well, they're telling me about these Kuwaiti oil field fires and all the animals are sick and they say the range is no good anymore. Seemed like, oh, there's some kind of association here. But the more and more that I dug into these interviews and what they had to say, the less firm I became about that conclusion, right? Because suddenly, from these interviews, all sorts of other factors started to pop up that explain the land degradation, overgrazing, animal disease, and mortality. And I don't have time to talk about all of them. And we don't deny the fact that the Kuwaiti oil field fires might have had something to do with it. But there are all these other factors that have led to this multiplication of animals on the land. I could pick one or two and sort of talk about them. Impermeable borders is a good one. Used to be like that old guy that we just saw. When conditions were bad in his typical range, he would take his animals and go to Syria or go to Iran or somewhere far away. Nowadays, these borders keep people in the same place within Saudi the whole time. So if the land is good, or if the weather's good or the weather's bad, the animals are there to denude it one way or another. I could talk about some of these other factors as well, but one of them that became of particular interest to me was the introduction of this skilled transnational underclass. And what I mean by that are these men. Right? These are not Saudi men, right? And it used to be that the number of animals that a Saudi Bedouin family had on the range was limited by how many sons and sometimes daughters that they had to manage those animals, right? So there was a familial labor limit on the number of animals that kind of kept things in check and somewhat sustainable over long periods of time. But now it's an environmental calculation. They can hire these guys from places like the Sudan or Afghanistan for sometimes about $120 a month, sometimes even less, and they can hire as many as they want, and they can stick as many animals out there as they want. I was blown away by the fact that just about all of the work, I mean, I went like anybody with these kind of romantic notions about the Bedouin nomads, and what I discovered were weekend warriors, right? These are guys who have a house in town, their kids are in school, and on the weekend they come out to their camps, and there's all these guys kind of running the operation, and they hang out in the tent and drink tea and kind of manage things. And then Sunday night, or Saturday night in Saudi, they head back to town and start the next week, right? And then, after this whole desert episode was over and we were back in Jeddah, I was a capital city, one of the cosmopolitan hub of Saudi, I was blown away by how many foreigners there were in Jeddah. It didn't even feel like a Saudi town. It felt like a kind of Filipino, Indian, Pakistani kind of city, right? And I was very, very interested in that, right? And I also did not want to spend two more months away from showers and toilets. So I proposed my dissertation research to go back to this region and to look at this foreign laboring population in the region. And I thought I would go back to Saudi and my contacts, and Saudi said this is way too sensitive, it'll never get approved. Which strangely ended up being wrong, but it was too late for me. So I ended up going to Bahrain in 2002 and 2003. And we've heard a lot about Bahrain in the news, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that later. So this is the second research project that I want to talk about. And I decided that I would focus on this foreign labor contingent, and through a long chain of events, I ended up in Bahrain, which I actually didn't know much about Bahrain. I didn't think I was going to go there, but that's where I ended up. And here I am in one of the labor camps conducting these interviews. And I'll show you maybe some pictures. Well, I guess we'll start with this graph and then go to the pictures. It's sometimes hard for us, I think, in a country like this, where we're accustomed to foreigners or immigrants or migrants constituting a minority, and this relationship is kind of stable, to really think about what it's like in some of these Gulf states. The bottom one here is probably Qatar, and then the Emirates. And this yellow portion here is the number of foreigners that are there. And this is actually, these data are actually old. So now, in a place like Qatar, 85-87% of the people who live in Qatar are these non-citizen foreigners. Guest workers would probably be a good sort of Americanization of who they are. Imagine what it would be like to be, like, go out your front door and 9 out of every 10 people are these temporary kind of transnational foreign workers who don't speak the same language. That's the kind of scenario that, in very broad and general terms, that I was interested in exploring. Where do these workers come from? Well, they come from all over the place. And actually, every time I go back to the Gulf, suddenly there are these new labor contingents in the camps, right? So some of the traditional places, you know, over the past decades that they come from is certainly South Asia is the predominant source of this labor, right? So places like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, more recently Nepal has been sending huge numbers of workers to the region. The Philippines send a lot of people, and especially women who work in houses, right, as domestic servants and things like that. Indonesian women compete with them, as do Sri Lankan women, and there are Sri Lankan men there as well. We also see migration from parts of North Africa and from other parts of Africa and from other parts of the Middle East as well. These huge influxes of people coming to work in the region. And then I go back to Qatar in 2008, and suddenly there are these huge dormitory-style labor camps full of Vietnamese people, right? We're full of contingents of labor from Ghana and places like this. And so there's this kind of rapidly changing characteristics to migration in the Gulf, like many other places, like the United States in some ways as well. So this is a picture that I put on the cover of my new book. I know it's a little dark. But I don't know. Well, what do you see? Any comments on this picture?
No women.
Okay, it's all men. So first of all, this is the center of the city, in the major city in Bahrain, on a Friday afternoon, the day off, the first and for most of these men, the only day of the weekend that they have off. So not only are there no women on this street, right, except for my wife who was taking this picture, and she was uncomfortable, actually, but what you might not recognize is there's also no Bahrainis. There's not a single Bahraini in this picture, right? These are all South Asian men on their day off, and they flood these portions of the city and take over many of these public spaces, which raises all kinds of anxieties amongst the city. And so what I did, as anthropologists do, was I went out and I gathered what I call migration narratives. And for this project, I talked to 66 men and a few women, and I basically started with questions like, where do you come from? Tell me about your home. What did you do? Tell me about your family. What did you do before you came here? And then I sort of focused the second half of the interview on what kind of problems do you have here? What kind of challenges have you encountered here? What do you think about your labor conditions? What do you sort of hope to do in the future? And I had this kind of interview guide that I followed, and I did 66 of these interviews. And my analysis is sort of starting to connect the dots between these experiences. Like, what are the patterns and characteristics that connect it? Now, it might be hard to find me in this picture. This is me right here, okay? In one of the labor camps that I would go and spend. I spent, you know, probably every other night I was out in one of these labor camps sort of hanging out and talking as best I could with some of these men. And here's just some general pictures. This is sort of the morning as before they go to work. So in Bahrain, they ride around in these open trucks. So laborers are carted back and forth to their workplaces in trucks like this. This is a common sight. This is the luggage of the new labor contingent on its way to their labor camp. And you see these going back and forth from the airport all the time. Wow. So it kind of gives you a kind of idea of the scale, right, of this migration. This is just one of those kind of lazy afternoons in the camp, which not really lazy for them. On their day off, they're trying to procure water supplies and they're doing their laundry and trying to get ready for the next week ahead. These men typically work 10, 12, sometimes 14 hours a day for 6 days a week. So this day becomes a very packed and busy day. Yeah. All kinds of things, but I would say over half of them are involved in construction. So here we in the United States, we have small construction crews that build very large things. But here it remains much cheaper to hire these men and do a lot of construction. But they do all sorts of manual labor, right? All sorts of manual labor. They're essentially, you know, we hear a lot about these astonishing modern sort of buildings and cities that are being constructed in the Gulf. But most of them are being built, you know, hand over hand, cinder block by cinder block, by men like this, right? Oh, there is no compromise. Yeah. So a single labor camp, usually the men divide and they choose what room they're going to be in. And, you know, it can be, you know, Malayalam, South Indian language in one room, and then Nepali in the next, and then Bengali in the next. It's really, really quite interesting. I don't speak any of those languages, right? Which was a big problem. So I cultivated a small set of three field assistants who helped me with the translation. Now, just about every labor camp, it was pretty easy to find someone who could get by in English, and so we would kind of work with them as well. But because of this wide array of languages that one encounters, it was one of the real challenge for my work. Here's a picture of a lunch break at one of the building sites where they're working. So some of the basic conclusions that I came to, as I said, I was trying to sort of draw these patterns. A lot of what I have to say has to do with the labor contracts and the visa-related debt. Interestingly, all of these men pay thousands of U.S. dollars for the right to come work 2 years for approximately $150 to $200. That debt is held in the sending country, but they're working in the receiving country. And that the transnational debt is a big problem for them, because if something goes wrong, or if they don't like the conditions that they're given, and they lose that job, then their family is sort of lined up to carry that debt. And families and households can collapse as a result of that. Typical problems are the non-payment of wages. Because of the way that this migration system is structured, it's a totally viable option for the citizen sponsor, and all migrants are associated with a sponsor. Very easy for them to decide, I'm just not going to pay these guys, right? And usually that can go on for 4 or 5 months before they flee the only position they're legally allowed to work for and become illegal workers. And that's a huge problem. Also, the passports are confiscated, so that it becomes very difficult for them to return home. They often have to bargain with the person that they've run away from to get their passport back in order to return home. They sign a contract in the sending country, but when they get to the Middle East, they typically are asked to sign one in Arabic, which they can't read, and those contracts can be substantially different than the one that they thought they had agreed to when leaving their home. Unsafe working conditions, extremely poor living conditions, and then no legal recourse. In fact, within this sort of sponsorship system, their legal representative is the sponsor, who is also the person who profits from their labor, which is a very problematic way to kind of arrange migration. So, my new book, excited to have it out. It's a long, long journey. Thank God. I got to the end of that journey. And this is basically my attempt to kind of to talk about this system. And in the interest of time, I think I'll just kind of speed ahead to the last segment of my presentation. So when I went back to Qatar, in Qatar, in Arabic, it's Qatar. And we teach our American soldiers to say Qatar. But here in America, I just say Qatar, because everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say Qatar. And they don't know what I'm talking about when I say Qatar. So anyways, fine with me. What I decided was that I learned a lot in Bahrain by going to these labor camps and talking to these 66 migrants, right? But I felt like I visited with these men once, and I said thank you, and then I was gone. And I thought that I might be able to really dig into this topic in more depth by, instead of trying to interview a whole bunch of people, to focus my attention on a very small group of people and get to know them really well. And so what I decided to do was to find 10 new migrants and to follow them through 2 years of their life in Qatar. And so that's what I did. And every month I would go back and I would check up on them and talk about what's going on and how they're adjusting and what kind of problems have occurred and what are they telling to their friends at home and their family at home and what kind of anxieties do they have and what's their next move. And so right now I came home with these massive interviews from these 10 guys over 2 years. And this is what I'm trying to work through right now. But I'll talk a little bit about some of the stories that I gathered. And I want to start with a story. I'll let you look at this picture for a minute. This is the story of one of these 10 guys. Okay, it's going to take me maybe 5 minutes to read it. My first interview with Roshan was on his 7th day in Qatar. We sat in a large, cool room in the institution where he now works as a custodian. It was his mid-afternoon break. As we talked, I noticed that his hands were covered with writing. I asked him about this, and he said that it was the names of his family, people he missed dearly, people he thought about every day. Roshan is a quiet, kind, and graceful young man, a disposition that is perhaps a strange byproduct of a lifetime spent in conflict and war. He comes from a village somewhere near Yatna, deep in the heart of Sri Lanka's Tamilian region, and near the epicenter of the conflict in Sri Lanka. His father was a farmer, his mother a homemaker. As his mother described it to me, Roshan was born into war. The conflict swept through the village when he was a toddler, and like many of their neighbors, the family fled their home in search of safety. They lived as vagabonds, moving here and there, and were gone from their home for nearly 4 years. When they returned, Roshan was able to start school. Although he was older than the other children, he flourished in the classroom. And by the conclusion of his secondary school, he was the strongest student in the class. An education beyond secondary school, however, carried him beyond the village, away from his family, into uncertainty, and perhaps, his mother said, into danger. His uncle's family had already been interned by the state, and in 2008, the conflict seemed to be reaching another crescendo. Danger was everywhere. On a late April day in 2009, Roshan left the village with his mother and one of his uncles to attend a wedding some distance away. His sister and her fiancé remained behind. Roshan arrived at the wedding in the evening, but a phone call from home set him into a panic. The rebels had stormed Roshan's village. He returned to discover that his future brother-in-law had been shot and killed. His family was devastated and his sister was disconsolate. Months went by in a haze. Finally, Roshan found work at a hospital and slowly grew comfortable with the job. At the end of that month, his supervisor asked him to accompany him and several other employees on a trip to a nearby town. The men were stopped at a military checkpoint, questioned, and beaten. Their identification and money was confiscated, and Roshan and the supervisor were taken to jail. They were both accused of involvement in the LTTE, or the Tamil Tigers. He was held for many days. His brother arrived and tried to plead his case, but he too was beaten. Finally, his family raised 15,000 Sri Lankan rupees, and he was released. Several other men from his village were working in Qatar. His mother told him that he would go to Qatar as well. It was described to him as an amazing place, a great place to make a living. For Roshan, it would also provide an escape from the violence encompassing his life in Sri Lanka. It took many months for the plan to come together, and the arrangements were not easy. His mother sold her jewelry, and his family borrowed lots of money. They paid about $1,000 for the work visa. After paying the money to a labor broker in Sri Lanka, Roshan was shown a contract that guaranteed him 12,000 Qatari riyals a month, or about $390. He would be working as a custodian, or a cleaner, in the parlance of the migrants in Qatar. The flight to Qatar was a traumatic experience for Roshan. It was his first time on an airplane, and he was out of sorts. He developed a fever, and the heat of Qatar only seemed to make things worse. For reasons that remain unclear, he was shuttled between several different labor camps for weeks after his arrival. The food was unfamiliar and awful. Finally, he was relocated to his permanent camp on Street 43 in Alatia, or what is in English called the industrial area. Other than that, the bus ride to and from work, the industrial area is the only Doha that Roshan really knows. Roshan works 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. He and the other men leave camp at 4 in the morning and they return at 10 at night. He and his roommates cook when they get home, then sleep. Roshan, like most of his roommates, spends about 250 Qatari riyals every month on food. That's about a third of his salary. The camp itself holds about 300 men, all of whom are from India, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. When he arrived, his small room was home to 6 other men. Recently, however, the company has doubled up all the rooms. The men sleep 2 to a bed, 4 to a bunk. They suffer in the cold of the winter season and lack sufficient blankets. The camp has other problems. A massive trash pile behind the camp walls caught fire at the end of summer, immersing the camp in a hazy stench. The water supply is severely insufficient. He and the other men clandestinely collect water for drinking and cooking at the institution they clean and smuggle it home on the bus. Roshan showers at a friend's camp on Friday, his day off. It's difficult for the men to do laundry, and the employees of this institution at which he works periodically complain about their appearance and hygiene. When Roshan arrived in Qatar, he discovered that the company wouldn't pay 1,200 riyals a month he was promised in Sri Lanka. Instead, they would pay him 600, although there were vague promises of possible overtime. Moreover, they held back half of his wages for the first 2 months. This money, he was told, was to ensure that he wouldn't abscond to another position. He has not been issued an official ID card and isn't certain that he will be issued one, as many of the men who've been there for a long time still lack this card. Without that card, he can't buy food on credit at the local store, and he's afraid of any encounters with the police. Roshan has never met his Qatari sponsor. His point of contact with the company is a Filipino woman at the manpower agency, but she doesn't help with problems. There's also a Sri Lankan supervisor who monitors the men as they come and go from camp. He doesn't tell his family at home about his difficulties, but he has trouble explaining why there's no money for them. They are clamoring for money. After all, he's in the Gulf, where the streets are paved with gold. On Fridays, he and a friend have been slowly cooking up a plan to sneak away to Sri Lanka. His only wish, he notes, is to leave this place. So those are the kind of stories that I've been working with. It's kind of, I mean, it's typical and it's not typical. There's a few success stories and there's all kinds of disaster stories. And these are the stories that right now, when I have time in my office, I'm reading and rereading and trying to weave together into some kind of coherent narrative. I'll show you the grant that I had to do this work. interestingly, also provided money for me to go and visit with the families of these 10 men that I was interviewing in Qatar. And so here I am in one of the houses in India. Their son, this woman's son, is working in Qatar, and we're visiting his family. One of the great success stories out of these 10 men that I interviewed. He's sending home, relatively speaking, buckets of money to this family, and they're rising rapidly within their community. This is another one of the families. This was in Nepal, down close to the Indian border. And this is another family with a son there, and this was the other success story from these 10 men. And their son, an older man actually, works construction. And interestingly, you're starting to see all these kind of Arabesque houses pop up all over South Asia. I mean, they're building them in the Gulf, and the style points are sort of making their way back into the architectural vernacular in South Asia. And here's one of the highland homes in Nepal, a little kind of hilly community on this really marginal land, deforested, denuded really. And interestingly, this whole community, really just women and children, or a few old men are left here. All the men are out elsewhere. And there's a lot to say about the sort of impact on families and communities when, in places like Nepal, all the men are gone, or places like the Philippines and Sri Lanka, all the women are gone. And here, the young man who is about to leave for Nepal from this same village, right, and is excited to go. Interestingly, and I know I'm probably almost out of time, all of the men were very, very, very excited for me to visit their families, right? They were just ecstatic that I was going to go see their homes and get to know their communities and families. And after that initial excitement, they were nervous. And they started to talk to me suddenly about things they had never talked to me about before. Like what not to talk about when I'm at home, okay? And I'll tell you this story from when I was in Bahrain. In that part of the world, you need a preposterous number of passport photos for every document that needs to be documented. And so I ran out almost the second day. I was out of passport photos. So I went to this photo shop to get more. And I go in the back, and there's the studio back there. And I'm about to start, stand where I'm supposed to stand to get this picture. And I notice to the side there's a desk, right, like an office desk with pens and a sort of empty paper container. And on a clothes horse, there's a jacket like this and a tie, a clip-on tie. So I asked the guy, like, well, what's this all about? And he said, well, this is where, the laborers come in and they dress up and pay to have this picture taken of them at the desk that they send home to their families, right, to kind of disguise the fact that they're, working in construction or menial labor, cleaning toilets, whatever it may be. And so I don't feel like I'm deep into the data that I have from this project yet, but the first paper that I've written about this, which is going to be published in a couple months, answers the question that I get asked the most. After I describe how dire the circumstances are for laborers and menial laborers in the Gulf, I get asked this question, mostly by economists actually. Why do they keep coming, right? Why don't they just not come if it's so bad? And so I have a paper where I try to answer that question. And I think the first thing is, when you think about Roshan's story, first of all, the extreme poverty, political violence, and economic violence of the places where these men come from. Oftentimes, the opportunity of an opportunity is something in and of itself, right? And that does exist in the Gulf. Second, there's these labor brokers in the sending countries that purvey both misinformation and disinformation about what these men will encounter when they get to the Gulf. But I also became very interested in this last topic, and I spend the last portion of the paper talking about how migrants themselves are participants in this system, right, that sends very poor information back home, like these photographs of the man behind the desk, or like the fact that, when I would take pictures for the first time in the labor camps, I would make two copies and say, here, you can send these to your families. And they're all like, oh no, we would never send pictures of the labor camps to our families. And now, Facebook, right? Some of these guys are on Facebook. There's sometimes a computer around in the labor camps. sometimes at work they can grab a, you know, get online for a little bit, and they love Facebook like everybody does, right? And I, with permission of one of the guys that I worked with in Qatar, I'm using some of the photos from his Facebook account, right? Now this is what I've been told by my Qatari students. This is a purse maker. This company, they make fancy purses. Like my Qatari students, the women from Qatar, they have like the $2,000 to $5,000 purses that they bring to class. And so this is a very kind of popular place for them to shop. And here's this sort of green landscape, right? Which is only in these manicured spots within the city. And here he is at Virgin Records, And here he is with a laptop on some rocks in front of this kind of beautiful part of town. These are the kinds of pictures that go up on Facebook, right? And yet, I mean, here's the pictures of the everyday life, right? This is the labor camps, the kind of places that they spend most of their time. And so, I mean, to be clear, what I argue in this paper is that these are for very understandable reasons, right? Most of the time, as we engage in a conversation about this, they're protecting their families from concern, right? They don't want their mothers and brothers and sisters to worry about them. And this kind of discourse about anxiety in South Asia in particular, this is something that they talk about and recognize in themselves a lot, like tension and anxiety. But nonetheless, when we think of it all together, there's a lot of information like this that kind of deceives these young migrants about what they're going to face in the world. Kind of a strange note for me to end on, but... That's the three projects that I wanted to talk about, and I would love to answer any questions, if I can, that you guys have. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'm just curious about the spot out figures.
So all different, right? So it goes from these manpower agencies that literally provide menial labor. They have thousands and thousands of men organized in multiple camps, run through one agency, right? Down to like a person who wants a driver or a gardener for their yard. All of those are arranged under the sponsorship system. But at the household level, it's like the Qatari citizen is literally going to the ministry and sponsoring this individual and working with an agency that will help find somebody for them. Or sometimes, if they have somebody they like, saying, find somebody else that you can bring, right? Now, at these larger levels, even though there is officially a citizen who has to be the official sponsor, right? They oftentimes have no contact at all with this portion of the business. Basically, they are profiting from and lending their name to that business, but there's a whole hierarchy, you know, that starts typically, like, if it's a Qatari sponsor, the next person down would probably be a non-Qatari Arab, like an Egyptian or a Syrian guy. And then below that, it might shift to someone like an Indian. And then below that, maybe more Indians. And then the laborers are at the bottom. And so there's no ability for these laborers to connect with the sponsor. It's very rare to connect with the person who is sort of legally responsible for their well-being while they're there. Does that answer your question? I would also say that I noticed that things are oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes worse in the smaller businesses than they are in the larger ones. The larger ones are often corporations that are working in sectors where there's more attention to labor practices and more overview of labor practices than there are in these smaller businesses. So things can be worse with these smaller companies. Yeah?
Probably they're angry, but how do they handle, do they feel betrayed and anger, and do they just give over in defeat? Or do they have a support network around them that they can kind of express their anger? Yeah, I'll get back to Sri Lanka, for example. Would they then expose, or would they try to guise up to cover them?
Okay, so I'm going to treat that as two different questions. And the second one, definitely. So the places where there's been long-standing migratory connections, and the most noteworthy would be Kerala in South India, right? This region goes back hundreds of years in terms of its connection to the Gulf. Very few Keralites at this menial labor level, because they know the game, and there's this kind of community knowledge that's been built up. So that's part of the reason why we see these new labor contingents arriving all the time, because in the big cities, there's the main sort of labor broker. And he has a group of sub-agents or dalals, or what they're called, who literally scour the countryside and looking for people that they can profit from, you know, by sending them through these migratory conduits. And so they're actively seeking out places and people where there is no opportunity and people don't sort of know how this game plays. Now, the first part of your question, I mean, yes, these are smart people, and it, you know, their first months are bewildering, they're overwhelmed, but they figure out ways to deal with this. And actually, becoming here, sort of being an illegal worker, is kind of like you arrive illegally, right? And you got problems. But there in the Gulf, becoming an illegal worker is often a move towards empowerment, right? Because you're moving typically away from an exploitative, abusive situation. While you're suddenly illegal and could end up in jail, you suddenly are in the black market where you're kind of choosing your own terms of work, right? And over time, I would say, what both of the success stories that I've pointed out here, they left bad situations, and what they found was a Qatari sponsor who said, pay me $500 a year, I don't care what you do and who you work for, we'll pretend you're a gardener at my house, go out, work, pay me $500 a year. And so suddenly, they're free to become entrepreneurs, find their own work, set their own terms, negotiate everything. That's sort of like, you know, something that a lot of the men are able to succeed with. Okay? There's a lot more.
Sure.
There's more to that answer, but that's a good start at least. Yeah.
What role are these migrant laborers and workers, are they playing in the current unrest?
So, this level of worker, totally uninvolved, right? I don't think I was able to really encapsulate how separate their lives are from, say, Qatari lives, right? They know nothing about how Qataris live, unless they work inside the homes. In fact, I presented this paper at a conference where I collected the sort of myths and rumors that they tell about Qataris in the labor camps, crazy rumors, right, about Qatari women sort of raping them in the desert and all kinds of just bizarre sort of stories that I think are really a testament to how little they know and understand, like, Qataris. They know them only from afar, right? But as you go up, and there's a top to this sort of foreign pyramid as well, people like me, I was there working for 2 years, and there's all kinds of other people who come from South Asia and places. And the reports from Bahrain, which is the country where we're seeing the most conflict, is that these workers are siding with the king, right? They don't want this revolution to continue because they're scared that everything they've built and their opportunities and their businesses and everything that they've constructed is somehow gonna collapse, and that might be the case. Might be the case. So, provisional. Yeah.
So, yeah, I noticed before you started talking, there's a project coming here, so all the stories you've heard about here, these experiences...
Yeah, so... that's a great question, and there's no doubt that my knowledge about sort of the situation with female migrants is much poorer because of access, okay? Most of the women work in the domestic sector, and it's just impossible, and I'm pretty good, right? I've been in the Gulf a long time, and I know how to find ways to interview people, right? Even with these guys, it can raise suspicions if there's like a tall white dude hanging around the labor camps, right? And it can cause them, there's a vulnerability that I'm very attentive to. With women, it's almost impossible, like to go into a household and sit with a housemaid and ensure that the man or woman of the house isn't also sitting there and conduct an interview. So of the 10 in the latest project, I had one woman. And believe it or not, I have never met her, okay? Because we tried sort of at first and we talked on the phone, but it just wasn't gonna work. So I utilized a female research assistant who I worked closely with, who would meet her on her day off at the shopping mall, also a place where I couldn't meet with her, and would do the interviews there. And we would talk on the phone and facilitate it sometimes that way. But there are other researchers who are doing great, great work with domestic, female domestic workers. In fact, I mean, I think my friends who do that work would find this a bit of a provocative statement. But I think our interest and attention as a sort of, from the human rights sort of community, the attention devoted to women in some ways has eclipsed the much broader and more systemic problems that men face. And I'm not trying to diminish the problems that these the women in the domestic sector face, because it can be horrible for them. But we're talking like 8 to 10% of the labor force. And this 60% that I'm talking about, they sometimes kind of are in the shadows, you know, kind of fall in the shadow of this kind of domestic worker abuse discourse that the human rights community has been heavily focused on for the last 5 years.
Living in these camps, these also forced to pay for this?
Not usually, actually. Not usually. Usually the lodging is arranged by the people that they work for. But one out of 10 camps I go to, you know, suddenly they're like, yeah, they make us pay for electricity. Or, yeah, they make us pay for, you know, some kind of cleaning fee. Or, you know, there's not a lot of enforcement, you know. So, and if they don't have a sort of collective knowledge about their rights and the ability to assert those rights, it's kind of like whatever the manpower agency thinks they can get away with, they can often get away with. I'm starting to see some change in that. Two of the men, of the 10 men that I interviewed, had taken cases to the labor courts, which is, in the past, the labor courts have been entirely futile. And one of those two men actually had a judgment rendered for him against his sponsor. And for me, that was like a beacon in the darkness. I'd never heard of such a thing before. And at the same time, I think at the state level, in Qatar in particular, there's an interest in remedying this situation. And so there is an earnest effort, I think, to address it. But I think the problem is just so big and hard to deal with right now. It's just so comprehensive that they kind of don't know where to start. All right, go for it.
How much of the economy is based on this labor force? As you know, yes. Said, if our illegal immigrant force leaves, our economy is going to really tank.
That's a great question.
What is it there?
I think over 90% of the citizens who are employed in Qatar work in the public sector. They work for the government. It's a norm. It's an expectation. So every one of the recent college graduates, and there's some of you here, you wouldn't even think about working in the private sector. You work in the public sector. There's some very interesting reasons why that I argue have to do with the preservation of an Arabic cultural space, right? Like, these are the only places in Qatar where Arabic is still primarily used, where you can have a gender segregated workplace. You can follow some of the norms that these people, the citizens, still expect. The private workforce is almost entirely foreign, right? And all of this is done and accomplished by foreigners. So yeah, every citizen that I talk to is extremely uncomfortable about the proportion, the number of foreigners in their midst. But very few of them have any even ambivalence about this sort of developmental frontier of the national plan. And this is what these nations are doing. It's like they're building, right? Building in and of itself, I argue, building more city, taller city, more city, has become the key way that these states transfer wealth out of the state coffers to the citizens, right? Development is the vision. The work and the management and the guidance of development is the activity, and it's key to the political legitimacy. It's an organized system for maintaining political legitimacy and keeping citizens occupied and busy. Because right now in Qatar, they're going to build a city supposedly that's like the size of Brussels next to their existing city, and there's already empty buildings everywhere. I don't know who's going to live in all these buildings, but building in and of itself, I argue, has become essential to maintaining the political legitimacy of these.
Thanks for joining me. Sorry. And thank you, Professor Gardner, for his talk this evening. I'm hopeful that he will be able to linger after class for a little while.
Yeah, I can. I got an order.
For for those of you who want, and I hate to cut it short, but I could sit here and listen to him and all of you all evening long, but I want to be mindful of everyone's time. So would you please join me in...